Welcome to the EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference Podcast. The EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference brought together the most influential IT decision makers and resources to improve the ability of higher education to achieve its mission. This podcast is sponsored by Juniper Networks and Quest Communications International. On this podcast, we feature our full interview with Lawrence Lessig, director of the Edward J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University and a professor of law at Harvard Law School. Our interview is conducted by Gardner Campbell, associate professor of literature and media and director for the Academy for Teaching and Learning at Baylor University. Here's our interview.
I wanted to ask you about some issues that you raise in Remix first, and then try to move from that into some considerations of some of maybe the implications for education, which gets a little bit of a buy in the book, I have to say. I love the book. I think it's really challenging and moving, but I want to see where maybe some of that might lead in terms of education as well.
Great.
And then maybe return back to some of the work you're doing now and some of your plans for the future. So I wanted to start with a question about terms of service as perhaps the new criminalizer. And by that, I want to offer a specific example. Your primary focus in the book is copyright, of course, but I was wondering to what extent you see terms of service on a service like YouTube, for example, which explicitly forbid the use of any of the content in any way that's not there on the website, as a kind of new and stealthy criminalization of remix culture. I think in particular about the example of Through You, which I don't know if that's a project.
No, I know that very well. Okay.
And so with Through You, you've got a very celebrated example of remix, which I think is spectacularly successful, which is an explicit violation of the terms of service of the very medium that it's on. So I'll just let you talk about that a little bit and offer your thoughts in that regard.
Well, I think that in principle, there's a problem created by the terms of service reaching far beyond what they need to in order to achieve their legitimate purpose. But it's less of a concern for me because the terms of service are enforced by contract, and the penalties for breaching a contract in this context are much less significant than the penalties for violating copyright. So that means that in theory, you're violating the rules, but the effective enforcement of those rules is going to be much less. And so I think that's a pretty significant difference here.
So how does that work legally? You say that the consequences are much less, but does that mean that YouTube has less recourse to the law, or that they're not able to police it as effectively? How does that work?
Well, the legal recourse is very small. So, you know, for example, in the YouTube example, I mean, in the Through You example, the question would be, what's the harm caused by that breach? And, you know, it's hard to see how there's any harm at all. So you might have, in theory, a violation, but no actual remedy. Now, of course, they could shut your account down, and in some contexts, that might be particularly significant. But that's the kind of limit of their enforcement, their sort of self-enforcement powers. Whereas in copyright, to the extent people allege that what the Through You project did violated other people's copyright, depending on whether the work was registered or not, it could be penalties up to $150,000 per violation. So when you're doing a remix, that can be quite a significant sum of money. So that's the sense in which I think there's a difference. It's just a property regime like copyright law is much more has a much greater penalty than the contract regime that terms of service imposes.
So if I were in a situation where I wanted to, let's say, share Through You with an audience as a particularly effective example of remix culture, and I decided because of, oh, let's say I didn't have access to the internet in that auditorium, that I wanted to be able to download that video so that I could show it, claiming fair use, academic setting, and so forth, the violation that I'm committing that is in violation of the terms of service, there's simply not as much of a consequence out there for me as there would be if I were to violate copyright.
Great. So if you violate the terms of service, the question is, what harm have you caused YouTube by violating that term of service? And the answer in the context you just described is no harm. So no harm, no foul. So you technically violated their terms of service. They have the right to cut off your account. But, you know, in the context of something like YouTube, at least if all you're trying to do is access material, that's not a very meaningful penalty.
So why would YouTube have terms of service like that in the first place if it really is pretty much something that's not going to have too many consequences? And the question behind that is there a chilling effect that these terms of service would have on the ability even to claim fair use in an academic setting?
The reason to have the terms of service structured the way they do is to basically give the company an out whenever the company wants a way out. You know, there's this meme going around right now about federal law. There's a, I don't know if you've seen this book, Three Felonies a Day, which basically says, you know, we constantly live life against the law, and there's all sorts of ways in which the government could prosecute us if they want, and but, you know, we basically have to rely on the government not overreaching their hand. There's something similar going on with terms of service. Terms of service sets up all these conditions that give the company the right to kick you off if they want to kick you off, but they're not setting up terms of service because they think they're going to get a significant amount of revenue from, you know, individuals who might violate it. Now, on the other hand, if it were some company or some educational institution, the ability to demonstrate damages might be easier, but it depends on the facts. But my view is they're setting it up like that just so that they have the right, they constantly have a freedom to basically decide whether and what conditions you get to stay on the system.
So on a very practical level, if a colleague comes to me at Baylor University and says, you know, I think it's really interesting, some of these videos up on YouTube, and I'd sure like to use them in my own work, but I'm not sure I can do that unless I'm actually on YouTube, and I'd rather not be on YouTube when I access this work. What would be the best recourse?
Well, you know, I think the other part of the question that you asked, and I didn't answer, is the chilling effect. And here's the way there is a chilling effect. You know, even if there's no ability to take legal recourse against somebody, many people believe, you know, they shouldn't violate the rules. So if the rules say you can't do something, they won't do it, even if, you know, if they did it, they wouldn't be effectively prosecuted. So the terms of service in that sense for the people who want to comply with the rules certainly do constrain or chill the opportunity to use this material in ways that, you know, one would expect that it should be used.
Well, an even larger concern growing out of that in my own practice and in my own attempts to encourage my colleagues to adopt new media and to experiment with the read-write culture and so forth has to do with the constant worry that fair use is essentially indefensible, or that it's whatever your attorney can successfully defend on any particular day. And the response then is often to retreat behind the walled garden of a learning management system like Blackboard, let's say, or something that's password protected. And inevitably, the result is that really interesting materials that could be remixed or that would have even greater value if they were out on the open web are locked away behind walled gardens. So could you talk a little bit about that in ways in which the sort of copyright issues and concerns have had a lot of collateral damage even within the sphere of teaching and learning in this way?
Well, I think especially copyright has had this collateral damage because there the risks are real. And, you know, if a university or a high school thinks about the exposure that they might be creating by encouraging this kind of remix activity, many of them, quite reasonably, will just say it's not worth it, and you shouldn't be encouraging your students or your colleagues to engage in uses that aren't clearly permitted by the copyright owner. You know, people constantly say the law doesn't matter because people will violate the law, and what they have in their head is, you know, a 16-year-old kid who doesn't care much as he downloads stuff from his favorite peer-to-peer service. But when they if you think about institutions and teachers and people inside of the educational system, they certainly will obey the rules. They're, you know, taught to obey the rules. They teach people to obey the rules, and so to the extent that the rules become salient to them, then it's going to constrain them in really important ways. And I think part of this, you know, frankly, is educators' own creation. Because, you know, for example, if you look at the open education movement, which of course is spreads everywhere around the world, where educators believe what they're doing is making materials available for other people to do, you know, to share and to build upon and so forth. At the level of theory, the system sounds great, but when you actually look at the details about what have been built, open education means everything from, I have a website up, but, you know, read the terms of service that says you're not allowed to download or do anything with the material here without my permission, to, well, you can download it, but you can't use it in any commercial purpose, you can't make any changes to it, or all these sorts of restrictions that are really inhibiting the underlying educational objective here, which should be to encourage people to be sharing and building upon and spreading this kind of creative work. And it's because, you know, we haven't, I think, in the education space, been careful enough about building an environment, to think of it as an educational, cultural environment within which this type of creativity is permitted, you know, technically permitted, that we have created this problem for ourselves. So part of what my objective is in coming to this conference, for example, is to try to push more the recognition of the need for us to take responsibility for our own environment. Like, it's one thing for the RIAA to be enforcing copyright as it relates to music, but we ought to be creating the environment that's going to govern how educational materials get built and spread and built upon by others.
As the open education movement goes forward and we start to grapple with some of these problems, do you think that we're beginning to grapple with some of the fundamental assumptions in academic culture itself? Another way to ask that would be, in your book, you describe two different kinds of cultures, and one of them is a sharing culture. It's the culture of Lewis Hyde's The Gift. To what extent do you think institutional processes in academia have actually not only been fought shy of the technical issues in terms of sharing these works, but also encouraged a kind of culture of retreat, one that's not really devoted to sharing, one that's kind of paranoid about ideas getting out and so forth? And I put that in a very extreme way, but I'm interested to what extent it's almost baked into the community, in your view, a certain culture of shying away from sharing.
Well, I think that this community, like any community, has people who are not committed to sharing or object to sharing and like to hoard and imagine that, you know, their idea is going to be turned into some movie and they'll make millions of dollars from it or whatever. I don't have a sense that it's greater in our community. I think it's in fact less. I think that, you know, it's more ignorance in the narrow sense of just people not thinking about the issue that inhibits this practice than it is a kind of, you know, true resistance to it. Now, I don't think that excuses it, because I think, you know, we should actually, we do have a strong ethical obligation to try to fix this problem and get it going in a way that will encourage the use and spreading of this material in a way that makes sense. But it means that it's not going to be as hard a problem as it is to think about convincing, you know, record label executives about, you know, a different way to make and spread culture. I think when you begin to have the conversation, people get it. And the best evidence for that, I think, is that when we started with the Creative Commons project, when we started getting educators to adopt the Creative Commons licenses to encourage open education and open educational resources, the first instinct of many people was, you know, a relatively restrictive license. But I think that the history of adoption has seen increasingly relaxed license adoption and migrating from a more restrictive license to a less restrictive license as people reflect upon what makes sense for the enterprise and begin to practice it. So I'm encouraged that we can make a lot of progress here, but I think we need to speak frankly about, you know, influences that have limited it and try to get around those as quickly as we can.
I want to drill down on that a little bit with some examples from my own experience and be interested to hear your comments. One is that when I urge some of my colleagues, not all of them, but some of them, to be more open in their own intellectual processes, maybe to experiment with blogging or to share the work that they're doing more widely on the open web, I'll typically get one of two responses. One is that there's a dread of letting people see the process of how an argument emerges, or of letting one's thoughts come out before they're fully baked, which, of course, having things out in that kind of draft form is very much what you celebrate in Remix as part of what prompts a culture of rewriting. And the second response I typically get has to do with it's the tragedy of the commons wrought large by tenure. If I give my ideas away, if I put these things out there before they are safely in a peer-reviewed article counted by my tenure and promotion committee and added up in my quota, I'll lose my job. Somebody will steal the idea. This would be something that would be professional suicide. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on those.
Well, I'm not somebody who actually believes that openness means that everything ought to be open. And I respect, you know, the idea of an unpublished manuscript. And, you know, there's certain things that I certainly understand and agree people need to keep control of until they're mature enough to be released. On the other hand, I think that, you know, especially we senior members of the academic community need to adjust our practices with respect to things like what's allowed to be published based on what's been available freely on the internet and what we count as tenure material, which journals should be available for tenure material, to encourage a better practice and more open practice of making material accessible and spreading it broadly. You know, when I, for example, and a number of other colleagues in the legal profession, in the legal academy, said that we would not publish in any journal that didn't give us the freedom to make our work openly accessible, you know, under a CC license. That was the sort of thing that only somebody with tenure at a great, you know, university or with tenure at a university they're comfortable with being at for the rest of their life could do. And I think it's our responsibility to do things like that, to make it easier for another generation that isn't necessarily tenured yet to do the same thing. So I think that, you know, there's a certain leadership role for senior people in this process. But I don't think that the leadership should be to say that everything should be out there. Now, I do think more should be out there. I think people should relax a little bit about it and recognize that the value that's going to come from making their ideas accessible for other people to comment upon and critique and to build upon turns out to be greater than the loss that they suffer from not having this exclusive control in many cases. I just heard this wonderful presentation by Clay Shirky where he was talking about, you know, the quintessential thing that made chemistry take off, which, you know, the move from alchemy into chemistry was the shift in a mindset from people who thought that knowledge would be produced by being as secretive as they possibly could to people who started practicing making all of the experiments and ideas that they're producing publicly available so other people could test it and build upon it and change it. And obviously the latter is what produced an explosion of enlightenment in the context of that field. And I think the same thing is true in general with ideas about this stuff. Now, that however, I would, you know, try to persuade people to and nudge them along to, because I understand that, you know, resistance to that is strong and nobody's going to be coerced into a different method of thinking. They've got to be shown.
So another way of asking the question would be, do you believe there's a future in considering modes of scholarly communication, which really is where the money is minted in academia? That's what we are judged on in terms of our own productivity, our own contribution to a research enterprise. Do you think that scholarly communication can actually participate in read-write culture, can have a read-write identity or a read-write ethos, and not simply the read-only, which has pretty much dominated many models of scholarly discourse? I think it might be fair to say, especially in the humanities, for a long time.
Well, I understand the sense in which you can see much of it as read-only, although I also think there's a way in which we can see a lot of it as the very best of the ethic of read-write, in the sense that, you know, if you look at the science publishes results for people to test and to falsify or to extend. That's the mission, and the practice of doing that to other people's results is, in this narrow sense, a kind of read-write practice. In the context of the humanities, as I say in the book, the activity of quoting and writing, building on quotes, is in its essence the same kind of rewrite. That's what we do all the time. The place that it becomes legally problematic is when you cross over from the text-based expression of these ideas into, you know, music or video or images, where the norms are not as well developed. And you know, if the question is, do I think that academics is going to be increasingly become increasingly like that? I do. You know, partly because if we want to continue to communicate to our students, we're going to have to learn to speak that language at least as facilely as we can speak the language of traditional text. But I think that the enterprise of academics, there's a period where you're forming something. Nobody says you have to necessarily reveal everything as you're forming it, but once it's formed, the whole point is to make it available for others to do something with. That celebrates a kind of read-write culture much more obviously, it seems to me, than you know, than necessarily a novel. Somebody who writes a novel or somebody even who makes a song. You know, those often are people who claim this is mine and nothing else should be done to it without my permission. That's not the academic's norm.
Well, you've anticipated my next question, which comes from a passage in your book where you talk about your life as a teacher and students coming to law school coming from an essentially read-only education.
Yeah.
And you trace something really interesting there, which I want to think about for a little bit. You say, for 4 years or more, I'm quoting, they sat in large lecture halls with a professor at the front essentially reading the same lecture she's given year after year after year. Any questions usually elicits points of order, not substance. Do we have to read chapter 5? Will the subjunctive be on the exam? And so forth. And I've taught long enough that I can rattle those questions off by heart as well. But so here's the question that emerges from that. To what extent have professors, academics generally, actually encouraged a kind of read-only education because it does fit in with certain kinds of processes in academia that simply make that a lot more convenient?
I obviously agree that it's a fair description of certain modes of teaching. But and if somebody tried to do that in teaching law, I would be critical of them because I think I know enough about what law teaching is supposed to be about and what it takes to do it that I would have the standing or the credibility to say something different. And I would even go as far to say that if I were charged with teaching a history class, I would teach it more like I teach a law class than the description that you just read. But it's another step to say, you know, that it doesn't make sense to teach in that way at all in any context for undergraduates. So I'm suspicious of that mode of teaching. And I, you know, my view is you'd have to defend it, especially in this context, because we're learning in so many ways about the power of teaching that's interactive read-write versus this read-only teaching. But that's an argument ultimately to be made by people who are in, you know, teaching a context where that is the norm.
Well, and if part of the argument of your book is that we are going to be living in an increasingly fertile read-write culture because of the ways in which digital technologies give one access to multiple and very vivid and effective modes of writing across many media, is there a sense in which the academy needs to consider read-write teaching even more carefully than we might have, even in the light of, let's say, learning theory? Because if we're in a read-only mode as we teach, we're certainly not we're not exploring the very riches the culture is beginning to offer.
Yeah, I think that's certainly right. And I think that it's at least incumbent upon us to evaluate which methods are working well, and which methods aren't. And I think that given the way in which technology is changing our kids, the idea that we can continue to teach them as we taught them in the 1950s seems extraordinarily naive to me. So we have to think, what's the way to teach that conveys information to a particular, to us, a kind of peculiar mind, a mind that is very different from the way our mind was at equivalent stage of our development, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. And so I think the challenge is whether we can keep up with that change, whether we can translate teaching into that new educational context. And my suspicion is that, you know, read-write is going to be an essential part of that.
When you think about the balance, and I'll offer a dichotomy here, which you're welcome to question. When you think about the balance between a kind of polemical encounter in education with something that's very much like a debate or a vigorous contestation of ideas versus opportunities for creativity, how do you see negotiating that kind of dichotomy, if you accept that dichotomy? And I ask because there's increasing emphasis in the literature on the absolute necessity of creativity, not simply for personal fulfillment, but because it actually represents a kind of higher order thinking, a kind of synthesis that is really at the heart of the way you describe rewrite culture. How are we going to fit that in with what may also be the need for this kind of sustained, focused, argumentative approach to the way we encounter education?
Well, I think that the recognition has got to be that there's no one method to it, and it depends on what you're trying to achieve at a certain point in the arc of a course, the arc of an argument or of a story. So, I find in my own teaching there are places where I'm going to set the context in a way that isn't going to be productive if every move is a question and every question is a moment for debate. So you build a context or a framework within which you then engage in a kind of activity that it is that through the activity teaches you something different or new. So I think that the commitment has got to be to increase the range of techniques, not to shift from one technique to another.
One of the things you said in the book struck me especially hard. You said the past survives only if it can beat out the future. And this will be my last specific education question, but I'm particularly interested in hearing whether you think our past models of schooling will beat out the future that the internet is already bringing to us.
I don't. Because succeeding in teaching is a requirement. And there's lots of pressure to test whether we're succeeding. And whether you're thinking about, public education, even at the high school range, or you're thinking about university education, these are all going to be increasingly competitive environments for evaluating what we as teachers do. You know, the context in which the past can beat out the future is when the past has nice, entrenched monopoly power that can push aside some future challenger. Well, we don't have monopoly power as teachers over the minds of our students. They come to us with their own view of how things are communicated and understood and spoken about, and we've got to adapt the lesson that we're trying to teach to that new view.
Do you think the result will be a kind of de-schooling or unschooling or edu-hacking? What's in the crystal ball that you look in?
I wouldn't say it's de-schooling or unschooling. It does feel a little bit like hacking because, you're problem solving with a bunch of materials that you've got before you. So now the materials are a differently structured mind from the one that you knew growing up yourself and you were surrounded by. So you got to hack through, got to be creative in figuring out how to solve that particular problem. The mix between what the kid is learning on his or her own versus the stuff that's being communicated by the teacher is obviously going to change. And in my view, the most important lesson in many contexts of education, obviously not all, but many contexts of education is going to be teaching kids how to teach themselves the relevant stuff they need to succeed in a certain field or sphere. And that's going to be about motivating a certain practice in the kid, not about conveying a pile of information to them.
So this leads pretty naturally to the next thing I wanted to ask you about, which has to do with libraries and Google Books. Mm-hmm. I've heard some of your recent presentations on the subject, and clearly this is a very difficult and complex thing to be thinking about and actually architecting as we move into the future. So I'd like to know, when you think about libraries and the question of access, what do you do with the question not only of access spatially or in terms of a personal right, but access also in terms of time? Because one of the things that a project like Google's or actually any university's that actually digitizes its own materials, one of the things that promises is access in a unique sense. That is, you can have just-in-time information at your fingertips as a marvelous affordance for self-directed learning.
Well, that's right. And I think that's both a good and a bad thing because it creates expectations in the researcher, which you know, we know will systematically exclude certain kinds of information unless they're all made available digitally. So, you know, what I think the, you know, the thing that's most tragic in my view about the Authors Guild and the Association of American Publishers fight against Google, what they're ignoring is that unless we find a way to make books relevant to our kids, books are going to become irrelevant. And it's not like we're going to teach our kids to give up digital environments. So we have to make books extremely relevant and directly accessible in the context of digital environments, or they will not be used. And so, you know, I once had a kid do research on speeches of Congressman Kastenmeier, who served in the Congress from the late 1960s until 1991. And the student came back and said to me that it's funny, but Congressman Kastenmeier never gave a speech on the floor of the House before 1986. You know, obviously,
right,
the database didn't reach before 1986, but hadn't even hit them that maybe there was life outside of the scope of the database. You know, that's not a transitory problem. That's going to be increasingly the norm. If it's not accessible within 5 seconds from my keyboard, I'm not going to look at it. So one response to that is to, you know, bear down heavily on the kid and say, you've got to force yourself to get up and go travel to the archive or travel to the library to look at stuff. And that's, of course, necessary for certain material, and we're not going to avoid it for a huge part of our past. But the other response is to think, well, how can we make sure that all of this stuff is accessible directly and easily and as simply as a Google search without, you know, burying it behind walls of DRM or complicated exclusive proprietary databases or the like. You know, I think the technology is a constraint on us as much as it's an opportunity for our kids. And we need to take that constraint seriously.
Why do you think it's taken a corporation like Google to actually step up to the plate and say, let's digitize everything? Why hasn't higher education, why haven't public libraries banded together and gotten started on it themselves?
Well, in one sense, surprising, in another sense, obvious. It's obvious from the standpoint that if you look historically, every great innovation is made by someone who's not the obvious innovator of the time, right? So it's always the outsider who sort of thinks about how to do the other person's job much better than they would have done it. So that in general, I think, you know, makes it likely that a company like Google would think about it rather than publishers. But the other point is that, you know, I saw Google at the early stages of them deciding whether to do this. And it's not like people didn't realize there was an enormous legal risk that was before them. And, you know, quite frankly, there are very few entities in the world that would have accepted that risk the way Google did. And, you know, they're not out of the woods yet. But every other entity that sat down and listened to their general counsel that didn't have all the money in the world in their bank account, and, you know, people like Larry and Sergey egging them on to do great and amazing things, would have said, you know, the risk is too great here. We can't, you know, the copyright owners are not going to begin to approve the way that we're going to do this. We can't afford a long fair use fight. If we lose the fair use fight, we can't afford the damages that are certain to befall us. So, you know, in some sense, it took a company that had enormous chutzpah to be able to do this. And certainly chutzpah is encouraged by enormous wealth. And the one thing we know about publishers is that they have neither that wealth right now nor the tradition of that kind of chutzpah.
Well, it's an interesting question, which came first, the chutzpah or the wealth? And I guess that would lead me to another question, which is, enormous wealth can make one available for being egged on to do amazing things, but a keen sense of mission can as well. And that's especially active in what you describe as a sharing economy. Why hasn't that kind of chutzpah emerged from within nonprofits like universities?
Well, I think that universities have been tempted by the siren of easy money and getting donations or striking deals or making arrangements with commercial interests, which themselves are not committed to the same values of access or enlightenment ideals, but instead, you know, obviously committed to obligations to make money. And I think that the focus on how does a university become like a company makes sense from a financial perspective, but is destructive from the perspective of the values of universities. So I think of the difference between MIT and Harvard. You know, in many contexts, MIT has embraced a set of practices consistent with the deepest, truest values of the university, like the MIT Open Courseware Project, making all of this material available for anybody anywhere to take and download and do with as they wish, contrasted with the Harvard Business School, which, of course, produces enormously rigid controls around the material that they use to teach their students. Now, the Harvard Business School will say, of course it makes sense because, you know, look at all the money we make. But I think that the real challenge here is to get people to recognize success for, you know, an educational institution is not the same as success for a for-profit institution. And you can't plead the for-profit success that you've achieved as a way of demonstrating the not-for-profit or the educational success that you're charged with achieving.
Well, it's sad to think that some of the most productive and essential defiance in society may have been bred out of one of its core institutions.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, Professor Lessig, that's what I have on the agenda to talk with you about. And I just also want to say it's been a real privilege and an honor to speak with you.
I appreciate that very much. Thanks very much for your time.
An interview with Lawrence Lessig from the EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference. This podcast is sponsored by Juniper Networks and Quest Communications International.